You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In August 2003, a suicide bomber drove a truck filled with 1,000 pounds of explosives into the UN headquarters in Baghdad. The building crumbled, extinguishing the UN's brightest star and 21 others. A new biography by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Samantha Power tells the captivating story of Sergio Vieira de Mello, once the UN's go-to guy for every humanitarian crisis from Cambodia to Kosovo. She's called her book Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. It's published by Penguin, and I'm delighted that it brings Samantha Power back to our show. Hello.
Good to be here.
Did you know him?
I did. We met in Bosnia in 1994. He was the number two official there in a faltering mission, not a bright light in his career or in the history of the UN. And he was known ahead of time as a cross between James Bond and Bobby Kennedy. So I thought, I got to meet this guy. If there's anybody that can be James Bond in this circumstance, bring him on. And at that time, he actually earned the nickname Sergio. Because he was seen to be too accommodating of the Bosnian Serbs, who were the principal aggressors in that war. So it was, again, a sort of dispiriting time and him not at his best.
How did he explain his actions?
Well, I mean, one of the things I've learned in spending the last 4 years with him since his death and trying to kind of retrace his footsteps is the decisions and that he had to make and the trade-offs daily about whether, for instance, in Bosnia, do you feed the victims? And if feeding the victims requires being obsequious to the aggressors, do you be obsequious? I mean, he would go, if he was meeting with Radovan Karadzic, the head of the Bosnian Serb political establishment there, Karadzic happened to have been a former psychiatrist. Sergio went rummaging around to try to find the perfect gift for the psychiatrist, and he found a New York Review of Books that had on its cover a long article on psychoanalysis and new debates in psychoanalysis. He came and he presented it very proudly in the hopes that that would then kind of grease the wheel and that Karadzic would be more accommodating of his demands on behalf of civilians. But sometimes it could tip too far in the direction of harm doers.
On the other hand, he also had to contend with all the pressures from back in the Home Office, where nobody agreed on anything and powerful forces were supporting Milosevic, just as many other powerful forces, were opposed to him.
Yeah, I mean, you see this in mission after mission. As you mentioned in your introduction, this is a guy who was in Lebanon in 1982 when the Israelis invaded, and of course the Security Council back in New York is completely divided on how to respond to the Israeli invasion and to Palestinian attacks out of southern Lebanon. I mean, again, this impossible situation. He's in the middle of it. In Bosnia, the United States and Russia, much as they are today, divided over Kosovo, hugely divided over what to do about the Serbs. In Iraq, the Security Council completely stalemated by the Bush administration's decision to go to war. So again and again, there's what's going on in New York among the major powers, and then there's Sergio, who's sent off somehow to be the symptom of international consensus when there's no consensus. He's supposed to be the purveyor of our ideals when we can't agree on how to implement our ideals.
Did you know the moment that you learned of his death that you would write a book about him?
That's a great question. No, I think all of us have this experience sometimes that when you know somebody and you're familiar with them, you don't maybe see them as large as the rest of the world saw them. I was struck at the coverage he got. There so many people said, gosh, you know, I wish I'd known more about him when he was alive. And I thought, oh, but it's Sergio. You know, it's Sergio, this amazing humanitarian and troubleshooter. But I think I underestimated him in some way. And the way I came to the project was that I began to ask questions about the last 3.5 hours of his life when he was under the rubble. And it became clear to me that there was an untold story actually about the rescue itself, or the non-rescue, the bungled rescue, where he was alive for a long time. And in some ways, he, almost like a metaphor for the work that he had done throughout his whole career, he was like a refugee under the rubble, kind of unowned, unclaimed. And so when I got into reporting that, I spent 9 months just looking at the 3.5 hours he was in this hole, basically waiting to be rescued. I then began to hear things about him from his colleagues and from others that made me think, wow, this is a person that is actually an incredible vehicle into, incredible person obviously, but also incredible vehicle into the things that are most pressing and most urgent today in the world. And that was when I made the decision to pursue a book.
Why did it take so long? There was an American military compound right next to the UN headquarters. I just spoke to a soldier who was in it and said he remembers being thrown out of his bed by the explosion and went to help dig out the people who had been buried under the rubble. Why did it take so long?
Well, this is what's so there's so many things that are tragic.
I mean, it's so sad that it took him 3 hours to die, and he probably could have survived if he'd been pulled out sooner.
Well, I tell you, it again is one of the many, many tragic offshoots of decisions that were made very far from the scene of this particular crime. Although the Bush administration predicated its war in Iraq in part on a link between a massive terrorist attack in this country and Saddam Hussein, amazingly, I mean, shockingly, disturbingly, the Bush administration went to war without actually doing any pre-war planning on responding to large-scale terrorist attacks. So there was a total disconnect between the justification, partial justification at least, for the war, and then the kind of planning and operational capacity that the administration demanded of U.S. soldiers. So when the bomb went off, there was literally no search and rescue unit associated with the U.S. forces who were there. I have to say the U.S. soldiers in the vicinity did a heroic job. You had two soldiers who, one of whom had been actually at the World Trade Center during 9/11 and had watched his fireman colleagues go into the building and die, and actually had stood outside the building and said, am I ready to do this again? Can I do this? Because the building was quivering, and it was clear that it was very possible that it could collapse inward, much as had happened in New York. And this young fireman, Andre Valentine, 5'4", goes into the base of the shaft. The buildings are quaking, you know, and he works for 3 hours to he manages to rescue an American, Gil Lusher, a wonderful refugee advocate, and in the end fails to save Sergio, but in part because he's using his helmet to pull rubble away from the side. There's no jaws of life or kind of cutting equipment to cut the rebar. They're using a curtain from one of the offices as a stretcher to try to bring bodies up. They're using a woman's handbag, believe it or not, one of those basket handbags, to actually transport the rubble. I mean, this is not the equipment that the most powerful military in the history of mankind should be bringing to bear to save one of the most valuable civil servants we've ever seen.
My guest is Samantha Power, whose latest book is Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World, published by the Penguin Press. Well, what was his background? What led him to even take a job at the United Nations?
He was born in Brazil, son of a diplomat, a Brazilian diplomat who'd actually been removed from the Brazilian Foreign Service after the military took over. Sergio told himself a story, I'm not sure how true it is, even after all my reporting, that his father had been removed for political reasons. And so he used to say, you know, I will never work for the Brazilian government. So here was this guy with, he spoke seven languages, was a natural diplomat, but he actually didn't feel he had a home in the Brazilian government. And I think his ambitions also, in terms of his statesmanship, were bigger than Brazil would accommodate, even after the military stepped down.
And he was so good-looking, so he also struck a dashing figure, which probably would have threatened an awful lot of people in power as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so what he did was he went, the amazing thing about him, in being in all these trouble zones, he also managed to get two PhDs in philosophy over the course of his 34-year field career. I mean, I don't know how he did it, one on Kant and one on Hegel. This is a real polyglot and Renaissance man. But he went and began studying philosophy in 1968 in Paris, actually went in 1967. In 68, became caught up in the student revolutionary activities, was beaten up by the Parisian police, was expelled from France. And at that time, he was a leftist. He was an anti-imperialist. He was very anti-American. And as he would have put it, he wore his leftism very, very loudly, again, as throwing stones at the police might indicate. And funnily enough, what he saw in the UN was an alternative to state power. And it's the great paradox of the UN is that it's two things at once. It's where we park our principles. It's where we, in parking our principles, we recognize that we can't trust states. to look out for the rights and the dignity of citizens around the world. Therefore, we have these rules that we put in place at the UN. But then the paradox is it's also a gathering of states of 192 countries. And I think Sergio only saw the first part of the UN when he first was drawn to it. He thought, okay, well, that's where if you're a do-gooder, if you're an idealist, that's where you'd want to go and work. But he wasn't there long before he realized the way to do work and the only way really to extract money, shelter, policing resources, peacekeepers, et cetera, was to go back to the states and actually convince them to be better than they had proven themselves in the past.
So your subtitle, The Fight to Save the World, starts off with idealism, but then is tempered by a sense of the practical, which he develops at the UN. And was he seen at the time as UN's go-to guy?
At the beginning, you mean?
When did they start saying, get Sergio, we have a problem?
I think that one of the advantages of being Brazilian and was that it was a, as it were, in quote, I put this in quotes, a good nationality, insofar as at the height of the Cold War, he was a person who could be sent in and people weren't sure on what side of that divide he would find himself. He was from a country that had itself been colonized, so he could sort of play the developing world card, but he had a Sorbonne education. He was a cross-dresser, basically. He could be in any room and chameleon-like, could make everybody feel as though he was one of them, which was an amazing gift. I would sort of date his arrival on the scene and also his awakening to being in Lebanon in 82 and actually being in Beirut in 1983 when the U.S. Embassy was hit for the first time by a suicide bomber, and then, of course, the Marine barracks were hit. For Sergio, there was a recognition that there was evil in the world, to use a phrase that's much in fashion these days, that you couldn't negotiate with everybody, although he never changed his view that you had to be in the room with everybody. And I mentioned the stone thrower and the rabble rouser of his youth. In Lebanon, he went marching up to one of the generals who had cross-trampled the UN facilities, and he said, Sergio ran storming up to him in his early 30s and says, what you have just done is unacceptable. And the general responded, you think this is unacceptable? You should see the 15 tanks around the corner. Those are unacceptable. And Sergio said from that point forward, he never used the word unacceptable again. So part of what this journey is about, I almost view it like the education of Henry Adams or the education of Sergio Vieira de Mello, the education of an idealist in practice, is how do you go about actually bringing constructive change to the most violent and broken neighborhoods on the earth? Sometimes spouting off about your higher principles isn't the quickest route to that.
But how successful was he? We're talking about an awful lot of crises that ended poorly.
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, half the time when I was working on this book, I was thinking, this is the most valuable journey to be on. He's in every broken place that matters over the course of Afghanistan, Iraq, Bosnia, Congo, Cambodia, you mentioned, Kosovo, Timor. I mean, every single, Sudan, Mozambique, Cyprus, he's there.
Did he go to Rwanda as well?
Rwanda, yeah, you name it. I mean, I don't think one could pick one practically that he hadn't been to and worked in and tried to make a difference in. And so, and one of the qualities he had that I really admire, he certainly has many flaws as well as we all do, but he was very adaptive and quite self-critical. And so that meant that he was growing in these missions in ways that pure ideologues would not be, or people who were less self-critical would not be. But I, for all of the richness of this journey, I asked your question often as well, which was, well, gosh, I mean, is it always two steps forward and one and three-quarters steps back or even three steps back? And what one has to ask oneself, I think, in all of these places that start off so truly broken is one has to ask the compared to what question. You know, what would East Timor have looked like if Sergio hadn't governed it for 2.5 years, if he hadn't made a decision that Paul Bremer sadly didn't make in Iraq, and that decision was in order to exercise power in an occupying situation, you have to hemorrhage power, or else if you hoard the responsibility, you will also hoard the blame. Bremer didn't recognize that. Sergio did. Had he not, had some other UN guy gone in there and sort of, you know, liked driving around a big white vehicle and having a limo and so forth, not that Sergio, he certainly didn't mind limos, but that kind of flexibility, pragmatism, empiricism, rigor, it made a difference, and I think he had a way, no matter where he was, of actually respecting people's dignity, which I think is one of the key takeaways of his life. So if all he did in his life was do damage control. If all he did was work in lesser evil territory and make the people who he encountered feel as if they deserve to live in dignity, that's not a small achievement. But I think he did more than that. I also think he presented a face for a very discredited organization in some countries like this one that no one had seen before. They hadn't seen someone of these gifts stay in the UN. They'd seen the UN as a place you parked the cousin of the first counselor and the mission to the this. You know, it was a place that people associated with nepotism and some degree of corruption and so forth. And what Sergio did is he belied all of that by being just very, very good at his job. Doesn't mean he could achieve a huge amount because the world is so screwed up. But I think he maxed out on what was achievable, which people appreciated.
My guest is Samantha Power, who's the Anna Lind Professor of the Practice of Global Leadership at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, the author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 2003, also the Council on Foreign Relations Arthur Ross Book Award for the Best Book on U.S. Foreign Policy, and the Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction. She has, as a journalist, traveled to almost all the places that Sergio Vieira de Mello has, all the trouble spots of the world, and she's covered them for The New Yorker and Time magazine. Her latest book, Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. It's published by the Penguin Press. We will continue after this. We're back with Samantha Power, who has mixed careers as an academic, as a journalist, and more recently as someone involved in the American political process. We'll talk about that later. She's written a book called, her latest anyway, is Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World, published by the Penguin Press. Where was he before he went to Baghdad?
This is another part of the tragic tale. He was he had worked in East Timor, as I mentioned, as the viceroy, as the kind of governor in this totally paradoxical situation where the UN, which was the place where decolonization had occurred and, again, the principles of self-determination were enshrined, and yet then the UN itself was put in charge of governing people who didn't want to be governed, who wanted to govern themselves. The UN came in after the Indonesian occupation was ended by an intervention.
Although they are having trouble governing themselves, as we just heard.
They are indeed.
With the assassination attempt of the president.
Exactly, who was very, very close to Sergio José Ramos Horta.
Well, they both speak Portuguese.
He was able to mix and mingle there, and that's actually, that becomes relevant then in answer to your question. So, because when he would go to Iraq, he was very self-conscious of not speaking Arabic and actually how important it was for someone who came in, even at that highest level, to be an Arabist who really could make their way around the city and onto the street without 16 staff around him. But after East Timor, Kofi Annan, who was the Secretary General at the time and was very close to Sergio over the years, had to decide where to put this guy. He'd been the governor of a country, effectively shepherding East Timor to independence, and there weren't many great jobs for somebody at his level. I mean, the natural next job would have been effectively number two to Kofi Annan, but UN jobs are divvied up on the basis of nationality and so forth. And there was somebody in that job at the time. So he was given a job that was not an obvious choice for him, and that was the job of UN Human Rights Commissioner. And I already mentioned that Sergio was wherever the news was over the course of his 34-year career, even as Human Rights Commissioner, which had been kind of not quite a UN backwater, but not exactly a plum job within the UN system, not a job of great prestige. But when you think about it, of course, he got it at the time where 9/11 had just happened, where Guantanamo had just been opened, where we were suddenly having debates at the highest level in this country about whether waterboarding was legitimate. So he's Human Rights Commissioner at the time that really human rights had become mainstreamed as people discussed how to balance liberty and security with terrorist threats afoot and with lots of overreaction afoot as well. And so he also had to decide, what do I do about the United States? Do I use my pulpit here in Geneva to say you are not in compliance with basic tenets of international law, you're repudiating everything cherished in the international system in terms of Geneva Conventions and things that we've relied upon, even your military would urge you to rely upon. Do I denounce you from afar or do I try to get in the room? And the same guy who was called Sergio back in the Bosnia days, of course, was always the guy who wanted to be in the room. He didn't believe it actually achieved very much. And knowing President Bush, he's probably not wrong. I mean, that the president was so ill-disposed to the UN to begin with, was already taunting the UN as the kind of new League of Nations and warning it of its obsolescence, of its irrelevance in the run-up to the war in Iraq. So Sergio decided to get in the room, and actually was the first ever UN Human Rights Commissioner to meet with the president. A lot of people who were critical of Sergio within the UN said, ah, he's gaming it. He must be trying to become Secretary General. He must want to go to Iraq. The truth of this tragedy is that he actually called Kofi Annan as his name began to circulate. Bush was blown away by him, was totally charmed by him, probably the only UN official that Bush refers to on a first-name basis. And they talked about Sergio walked into the meeting, and Bush immediately sort of patted him on the back and said, "You look so fit. What do you do to work out?" And Sergio's like, "Wait, I'm here to talk about Guantanamo and the International Criminal Court, not my workout regimen." But they sat down, and they got along as men more than as officials. So Bush had a strong interest in, if a UN guy had to go to Iraq, let it be the person that I've met with, that I feel I can trust as a man. But Sergio knew that was coming, and so for the first time in his entire career, called up Kofi Annan's office, his chief of staff, and said, "Take me off the list." And Sergio viewed being in the UN like being in the military. Wherever you were called, you go, no questions asked. Sergio had a family. He was not there for his family for much of the time that his two sons were growing up, because he viewed it as, in a sense, the UN was more of his family than his own family.
So he was just going to go for 4 months.
Well, he said, "I don't want to go at all. I'm going to deal with my personal life. I'm going to get a divorce, marry the woman I've been with now for the last 3 years. I don't think the UN can make a difference in Iraq. I don't think the Americans are ready to listen even to us at a technical level about how to write constitutions, about how to do reconstruction, how to do policing. They're not interested. So why go and give a rubber stamp, in a sense, to this occupation?" Kofi Annan, and you can understand his perspective, said, "If anybody's going to carve out a space with the Americans, it's got to be the go-to guy. If I send some junior person, then we will be irrelevant. Then they will, I mean, the junior person or a non-Sergio is not going to get a meeting with Bremer. He's not going to win the respect." So he was Human Rights Commissioner before he went. He didn't want to go. He went begrudgingly, and he insisted that it just last 4 months.
Did he have any real impact?
When you look back, you say, if anything was to be salvaged that summer of 2003, Sergio was there to do the salvaging. I mean, he urged Bremer to scale back the demobilization of the army and get soldiers back reinstated, to end the radical debathification, which has just now been reversed or amended of late in Iraq. He did convince Bremer to create a governing council. Bremer wanted to instead create, I think he called it an advisory council. It was just going to be clear that Bremer was the king, and the squires would stand around and validate what he was doing. And Sergio said, "No, we have to signal governing authority." And Bremer agreed with that and gave it the title that Sergio chose, made it the governing council, but didn't fundamentally give it governing responsibilities. So it's hard to see real impact. I think that he was able to meet with Sistani and people who would not meet with the Americans, so he was a faithful intermediary. There were parties that would under no circumstances would, and especially clerics who would under no circumstances talk to the Americans. There were people like Muqtada al-Sadr that Bremer wouldn't talk to, the spoilers. Sergio was always in the room with them. So as a kind of, again, conduit, he was useful. Had he been listened to, he might have been very useful. But in many ways, the Iraq's tragedy was foretold. By the summer of 2003, so many of the decisions that would lead Iraq down the path that it went down into major sectarian violence, those decisions had been made upstream. And all Sergio was trying to do, in a sense, was put fingers in the dike wherever he could.
My guest is Samantha Power, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her last book, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. Her latest is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World, published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, since he seems to be a one-of-a-kind guy as well as the go-to guy, what's happened at the UN since? Has anybody been named to replace him? Is there anybody out there who's the new go-to guy?
Well, the former Algerian foreign minister, Lakhdar Brahimi, is somebody, for instance, who went to Iraq a year after Sergio died, when the Americans actually were ready, finally. They were desperate. They just wanted help with the elections. They didn't have the legitimacy there to make political choices that the Iraqis would respect. So Brahimi is seen as a comparable high-level negotiator, diplomat. What you rarely have, though, are people who do what Sergio did, which is stay within the UN system for an entire career and rise within it. The junior people within the UN are not really rewarded. I mean, it has to be said that the sacrifices Sergio's family made in order for Sergio to live this career are not sacrifices most families want to make. It's hard to know if even Sergio could be Sergio today again. I mean, he was willing to be away from home at the time that most mid-level officials want to watch their kids grow up and so forth. And so Sergio never took professional shortcuts. He always went where the action was and continued to grow on the job. It's hard to see that being a model for a life that has any attention to the personal as well as the professional. One of the things that I would hope in this book, who knows what will happen, but the possibility of the UN attracting people of his gifts may go up the more people know about Sergio. I think a lot of people, even my taxi driver on the way over, he said, "What are you going to do?" And I talk about this book about Sergio Vieira de Mello, and I get what I always get, which is this blank stare. And then I said, the man who was blown up in the UN bombing in August, and he said, "Oh, that guy, he sounded incredible." And so I think to move beyond the hagiography to the journey of the kind of battering of an idealist and the sculpting of a Machiavellian idealist in some ways in the end, and the man, I think the most crucial part, the man who lived his life dealing with broken people and broken places, which is where the central challenges to our country lie on the horizon and to the global order more generally. I think if people could walk in his footsteps, maybe the temptation to do this kind of work and to bring ingenuity to it, not just from people who consider themselves idealists or human rights types or peaceniks or humanitarians, but actually from people from other worlds who just say, I want to help. I want to be a part of this. And then the question becomes, can the UN keep that kind of person? Can there be a retention strategy? And it's the same question the U.S. military is asking, the U.S. Foreign Service is asking. It's not a problem unique to the UN. Big bureaucracies and institutions are having trouble these days.
Were you working for Barack Obama while you were writing this book?
Oh, yes. I say not because of Barack, but just, it was a balancing act. I left Harvard in 2005 and 2006 and worked, I like to say, as an intern in Obama's office. That's what it felt like sometimes.
He was already running for office for president?
A senator. He had just taken over. He called me, or his office called me in early 2005, just after he'd taken over his Senate seat. And amazingly, he had inexplicably spent his Christmas vacation supposedly reading, among other things, my last book, A Problem from Hell, on U.S. responses to genocide. So he just asked if we could meet the next time I was in Washington, and we were supposed to meet for an hour, and an hour gave way to 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, and entering the fourth hour, I heard myself say, why don't I just quit my job at Harvard and come intern in your office? I mean, I was so blown away by the interrogation I was subjected to in terms of American foreign policy. And he was very determined, even from an early stage, to try to figure out how to move beyond just whacking George Bush and criticizing him, which seems so very easy, to formulating a constructive alternative foreign policy agenda. And so I went down and I worked there, and I worked on the book at night and in the mornings and so forth.
He has been criticized, or was criticized, when he said that he'd be willing to talk with anyone, including people that we consider our enemies. What did you have any input on that, talking to him about Sergio?
Well, we had long chats. He was working on his book, Audacity of Hope, actually also by night. So we had a lot of conversations about these. George Orwell says writing a book is like contracting a fatal disease. And so we were both in our misery, spent a lot of time talking about both of our endeavors. And certainly he knew that side of Sergio, but I think it's much more in keeping with Obama's MO. I don't think Sergio or I had anything to teach him in that way. I mean, I think this will sound like a stretch, but the same way that he has always wanted to be in the room with Republicans, even though he's totally pro-choice and has a 100% record from Planned Parenthood and so forth, he's always been prepared to actually engage with pro-life people. He's an engager. He's not somebody who stands across the room, arms folded, and denounces.
Are you concerned about saying things on a show like this or elsewhere and having an impact? The New York Sun today went after you because of statements you've made about the Middle East.
Yeah, what I'm learning in this campaign, I'm a political rookie, that's for sure. And what's upsetting, of course, is the degree to which people just cherry pick things that you've said and use ellipses and then turn you into something they need you to be in order to discredit your candidate. I don't think anybody cares that much about me. It's just there are a lot of people who would like to bring Obama down, especially now the more success he's having. So it's an adjustment. As one who's always written about other people in power, it's probably a good lesson to be on the other side of it and to be written about. But I hope it doesn't change the way I do my own investigative reporting.
What would you say to people who say that he has a lack of experience, which is, I think, there are two criticisms we hear about Barack Obama: lack of experience and words are fine, but you got to back him up with real solid policies.
Yeah, I mean, I just think both of them are really, maybe I just will show you that I've drunk the Obama Kool-Aid, perhaps, which is now the third criticism, is that somehow now that we're all part of some evangelical cult of Obama, which is untrue. I mean, I think the words critique is very interesting. I call it the Cicero effect. I actually, if I take national security, which is the area I've worked on with him for the last 3 years, we've given something like 9 national security addresses. The other candidates in the race have, I think Senator Clinton's only given one way back at the beginning of the race. Because he was the new guy, we have the most detailed proposals on everything from nuclear terrorism, proliferation, to China policy, to how to revamp foreign aid, to what to do about Iran, et cetera. But there is a way in which his speeches are so mesmerizing and the media is quite enamored by them. I'm enamored by them. A lot of people are enamored by them. That it's been a challenge to actually get people to go to the nuts and bolts of what he's proposing. And I think in the debates, he's getting a chance to highlight some of that. On the experience question, I mean, he has 25 years of experience in public service. He has more legislative experience, if you count the state Senate, than his opponent in the primary race now. But also, it's what kind of experience and what does it buy you? He's been, for a guy to have lived in the inner city, given how many of the challenges in national security exist in broken places, to actually have had dirt under your fingernails and know when people take up guns instead of going to school is not an irrelevant set of experiences. To have been a constitutional lawyer when the Constitution has been chucked the last 7 years is not a relevant experience. So I think the composite of what he has to offer is manifest in his judgment on the big foreign policy issues.
Samantha Power's latest book is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Right to Save, the Fight to Save the World.
And the Right.
And it's published by Penguin Press. There's also a documentary coming out. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.